thank you again for being here. I don't know, there are a few new faces out there. I'm Lanny, my wife Marilyn Johnson, as Jerry shared. Marilyn and I have actually been with Alpha Omega Institute now for 20 years. We were actually working volunteer with them before we went full-time. The first 3 years was bivocational. I have a carpenter background, geology background, but also I was a contractor for a while. And so for the first 3 years, we'd go out on the road for 2 or 3 weeks. I'd come home and had a lot of contractor friends that would put me to work to help keep our ministry going. And I just praise the Lord for this because we are a traveling ministry. Most traveling ministries only last for 2 years before they fall apart. This is Alpha Omega's 30th year. This is our 20th year with them. So it seems to be an important ministry that God is really blessing. And I always just say it's really God's ministry. It's not ours. He's just given us the privilege to join him in his work. Remember this morning, oops, get the technical things, get this thing turned on. This morning, we basically put out the guidelines, what we're talking about. We did this morning, this evening, and tomorrow. We're talking about the two ideas we came from. And so most of you are here this morning. I'm not going to go through the whole thing. But remember, what's this down here? There's the goo. Who's that? And where do you go to see all these animals and live in one place? At the zoo. That's what evolution teaches, from goo to you by way of the zoo. Evolution teaches we're here strictly by chance and accident, one mistake on top of another. I used to believe in that very strongly for 20-some years. I was an atheistic evolutionary scientist that argued with anybody that the existence of God could not be because evolution was a proven fact. Until I was challenged to really go back and really look at that evidence. Look at the evidence. See, I was always arguing this stuff, but I'd really never looked into it. I just assumed that my professors had taught me the truth, and, you know, I could step back now, and they were teaching me the truth as they saw it, their worldview. But I could look back, and I had a big problem with the worldview that I believed in. Once I really looked, it did not fit with science. And so what I was seeing was lots of design. As this morning, I shared the design in the animals. And because of the design, that really led me to understand there had to be a creator. It never could have happened by chance and by accident. So I'm going to continue on this line today. This is one of my favorite ones, is giving glory to God, looking at the things that he has made. Now, it's mostly older people in here. How many of you, though, like to play hide-and-go-seek? Like to play hide-and-go-seek? Good for you. I'm almost 65. I have to, in a couple of months, I have to sign up for Medicare, that whole bit. But I still like to play hide-and-go-seek with my grandkids. Now, when my first grandson came along, he was out there all by himself, 3 years old, no other grandkids yet. But we would get together and play hide-and-go-seek. Now, his name is Thaddeus Benson. We call him Thad for short. Now, Thad played hide-and-go-seek different than when I was a child. I don't know where he learned this, but he did have a different approach to it. What Thad would do is he would go hide. And the rest of the day, as long as we continued to play that game of hide-and-go-seek, he would go and hide in the very same spot. So if I could find him the first time, it was pretty easy thereafter. So I knew where he would be the second time around. So I'd just come in and I'd say out loud, I wonder where Thad could be. And I mean every time, Thad would jump up and he says, here I am, Papa, here I am. See, the whole point of hide-and-go-seek to him was not really to hide. You know what the point of the game for him was? To be found. And he wanted to assure himself that he was found. It's kind of strange because I think he's taught my other grandkids the same thing. They'll go and hide and they'll say, you ready? And all of them go, yeah, we're ready. I mean, they tell where they're at. I've got to teach them how to play this game proper. But anyway, all right? I believe it's the same way. See, I don't think our God, the one that made us, I don't think he's hiding either. I think he has left enough information out there that we can know about God. Now, again, the Word of God is the best way, but even in nature, as we shared this morning, Romans 1:20, for the invisible things of him being God from the creation of the world, are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made. All we have to do is look at nature. There's enough information in nature that we should know that there is a creator. And who is that creator? That creator is the God of the Bible. And as I shared, so that they, and that's us, are without excuse. There's enough information in nature alone that we should know there is a creating God out there. And that God is the one that made us. There is no excuse. The heavens declare the glory of God. It's designed, the declaration everywhere throughout the universe, that we have an all-powerful, wonderful God. Romans 1:20. There's enough evidence in this world to discover that God. Is there enough evidence in this world to discover the existence of God? Well, I think there is. So we're going to continue on that line. right now. Before I do that, though, I want to share with you, this is actually my life verse. I kind of latched onto this about 10 years ago. But we were reading, and I've read this verse I don't know how many times, and then you know how God, during a certain point in your time, in your life and everything, you look at the scripture a whole different way, and this one became very personal to me. It jumped out, and it was like, this is what God has called me to do as part of Alpha Omega. Isaiah 40, verse 9, lift up thy voice, lift up thy voice with strength, lift it up, be not afraid. Now, many times when we're sharing our testimony, our witness, or what we believe with other people, sometimes it's kind of scary, isn't it? Especially, you know, I think one of the hardest people to minister to, non-believers, is your family. You don't want, for some reason, you don't want to step on their toes. But I have to tell you, sometimes people kind of get angry about what you're bringing at them. And especially, you know, when we're sharing the creation thing, it can get very ugly at times. We try not to let it get to that point, but it has come to that point several times. This has been several years ago now. We were teaching in a very small community, had a small five little tiny churches. And because they didn't have enough kids, did every church do a vacation Bible school? They would take turns every year. One year, a church invited us to come and teach. And that was right about when we were beginning to do what we call a family vacation Bible school, where we teach adults and teach the children also. At that time, the way we were doing it was showing movies. My wife was in charge of showing the adult movies on creation. At the end of one of the movies, she had a lady come up, and this lady was furious. She got up in my wife's face. She was actually so close, she was spitting in my wife's face by her words. She was actually shouting at my wife. Essentially, she was saying, how on earth do you have the audacity to tell us that God made everything out there? How can you say that? And you know who this lady was? She was a lady pastor in that town right in there. We actually find out many times within the church there's more conflict than outside of the church. So sometimes they get pretty ugly. Now, I'm a big enough guy, they don't get that close to me. They don't want me to grab a hold of them just in case. I mean, I'm a pussycat, really, all right? But anyway, we don't have to be afraid of that, though. God has given us I can't think of the verse right now. He's given us a spirit of understanding of love, hasn't he, all right? And not of fear. Right, but it goes on to say, so lift up your voice, be not afraid. Sticks and stones may hurt, break my bones, but words can never hurt me. I always understand when they're mad at me. They're really not mad at me. They're mad at my message, or they're mad at who's behind the message. And who is that? God. Normally they're just mad at God when they're coming at us like that. So I don't have to be afraid because I have somebody on my side. So, be not afraid. Say unto the cities of Judah, say unto the cities of New Mexico, say unto the cities of Colorado, say unto the cities of the United States, say unto the cities of the world, behold, in other words, look at, take notice of, behold your God. And because we have a very personal God through Jesus Christ, I like to say, behold my God. Do you want to see what only my God could do that this chance and accident, this evolution could never come up with? Behold my God. So that's what I want to share, some more information. Oh, sorry, I do have one more commercial. On the back book, there's actually a booklet I have actually written about this subject. So if you're interested in it, this is actually, they're marked $5, but we sell them when we're out on the road for $4. This has a lot more information on this subject I'm getting ready to talk about than what I'm actually going to be able to teach right in here. So, and there's a lot of references and everything, so if you're interested in that, their booklet is, so that's, again, in the commercial. I really want to look at some of the design out there. The way I'm going to do it, though, I'm going to begin talking about this man right in here. This man's name is Leonardo Fibonacci. Now, with the name Fibonacci, a name like that, where do you think he was from? Italy, that's right. He was an Italian. And now, he was a mathematician, a very famous mathematician, and this was back during the 13th century. He was actually linked up to the royal court of Italy. At that time, the royal courts of different countries had their pet mathematicians, and they would not combat like in fight, but they'd have mathematical competitions that they would pit their mathematician against another country's mathematician. So they had lots of mathematical competitions. And Leonardo Fibonacci was very, very good. He won lots of these competitions. He was a brilliant man. We can actually thank him because he's the one that actually introduced into the Western civilization the numbering system that we use today, 0 through 9, the Hindu-Arabic system of 0 through 9. He's the one that introduced that into the Western world. He's also the one that more or less introduced the basic elementary mathematics that we learn in elementary school, addition, subtraction, things like that. He's also the one that kind of laid out that principle scheduled to be start taught in the Western world. And he did it by a book that he wrote. But in this book, he couldn't help himself because he did competition so much, he ended up putting a mathematical problem within this book for people to solve. And then, first of all, he turned right around and solved it himself. And this is what the problem was that he proposed. He says, let's suppose that there's a man that has this large enclosure. And in this enclosure, he's going to put two newborn baby rabbits. But he said there's something very particular about these rabbits. They're a little boy and they're a little girl. And these rabbits cannot start having babies together until they are 2 months old. But then, every month after that, once they start having babies after that 2 month period, then they'll have babies every month. But every time they have babies, it'll always only be one pair of rabbits, and it'll always be a little boy and a little girl rabbit. So given those conditions, his problem was essentially, in 1 year's time, how many rabbits will be in that enclosure with conditions like that? Well, he turned right around. Well, first of all, let's kind of lay out what he proposed. So in the first month, what he has in this enclosure, he has the two newborn baby rabbits. They're by themselves. They're not old enough to have babies. So in the first month, there are one pair of rabbits in the enclosure. The second month, they're still not old enough to have babies yet, so they're still by themselves. So in the second month, there's still only one pair of rabbits in the enclosure. In the second month, now they've had a pair of rabbits over here. So they have the original parents, and then the first offspring right over here, again, a little boy and a little girl. So in the third month, we have two pairs of rabbits in the enclosure. The fourth month, the original pair, again, they're having babies every month after that, so they have another pair here, but this pair is still waiting. They have to have one more month under the belt. So in the fourth month, we have three pairs of rabbits. The fifth month, we start getting a whole lot of rabbit begetting going on that starts increasing from this point on. But using this same method, you notice in the fifth month, there are five pairs of rabbits in that enclosure. What he actually did, he ended by solving his own problem, he came up with what is called the Fibonacci sequence, better known as Fibonacci numbers. And these are the numbers: 0, 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13, 21, 34, 55, and on and on and on, to like some of those shows out there, to infinity and beyond. But it just keeps going. These numbers never really stop. Now, a real easy way to remember these, if you look at these and can't really remember them, they're actually very easy to figure out. If you could just really remember the first two numbers, you're all right from that point on. 0 plus 1 equals 1, then 1 plus 1 equals 2. So here's all you have to do. You add the number next to it, it will give you the next Fibonacci. So 1 plus 2 will equal 3, the next Fibonacci. 2 plus 3 will be 5, 3 plus 5 is 8, 5 plus 8, 13, 8 plus 13, 21, and on and on and on. These are called the Fibonacci numbers. Now, if you have a sticky memory, good memory, you might want to take a snapshot of this and remember these numbers, because they're going to come up a lot the rest of this talk right here. Now, if you don't, it doesn't matter, because I will remind you when they are there. Now, by the way, the answer to his problem, in 1 year's time, there would actually be 377 pairs of rabbits in that enclosure with this sequence that he established. Now, if they'd been normal rabbits, there would have been a whole lot more rabbits than 377 pairs. But again, he put boundaries on it, right? Now you're probably saying, oh my goodness gracious, why did I come out on a Sunday night to listen to this man teach me mathematics? I hate mathematics. I don't want to be here learning mathematics. Well, I kind of like mathematics, but understand, I'm not trying to teach you mathematics tonight. What I am trying to teach you, though, there's principles throughout the universe that I think only God could have done. And I believe these Fibonaccis are some of those evidences out there. In fact, I like to call the Fibonacci numbers the fingerprint of God, a particular fingerprint, because I believe God has these fingerprints all over creation. But I believe the Fibonaccis are a fingerprint of God. And the reason I say that is because we see these numbers occur again and again and again and again and again, and I can keep on against for a long time. In nature out there. One of the places we find them is in the genealogies of a lot of the insects. For example, consider the male honeybee. Now, how many parents does the male honeybee have? Do you know? One, that's right. How many parents do we have? We have two. We have a mother and a father, but not the male honeybee. The male honeybee actually, without actually comes, only has one parent, and that is the queen bee. The queen bee can actually lay eggs, and without the benefit of a male, we can actually have male bees. So that means it only has one parent, the mother, the queen, right in here. Now, to get the queen, it's a little different, though. To get a queen, you have to have another male and queen someplace get together to produce a queen, but only a male to make a queen and a male to get the queen. So that means we have one parent and two grandparents, where normally we would have four grandparents. Then you go on from that point then, three great-grandparents, again, a queen and a male to get the queen, and a queen to get the male, so three great-grandparents, five great-great-grandparents, eight great-great-great-grandparents, 13 great-great-great-great-grandparents, and keeps going on and on and on and on. Do you recognize these numbers? What are they? The Fibonacci numbers. And we see it in a lot of the genealogies of a lot of insects out there, this pattern showing up time and time again. We look at things like plants. Now, again, if you recall, I'm a geologist, have background in geology, and I would look at plants like this, and I'd say, wow, all these limbs and twigs and things, everything, they just grow out willy-nilly any way they want to. But I found out I was wrong. There's actually a study in botany called phylotaxis. Has nothing to do with filing your taxes with the U.S. government. Although you probably need to be thinking about that pretty quick, all right? Well, what phylotaxis is actually the arrangement of leaves and branches around the stem of a plant. What they've actually discovered, over 90% of the plants they've been able to study have a definite arrangement on that plant, that species of plant. Over 90% of them that fall into a category we're going to look at right in here. To give you a kind of idea how it works, this is a drawing of what they call a king sugar bush, where this is the stem right in here, the stick right up in here. And you notice down here, you know, the leaves growing in this pattern here, beginning down at the bottom. And they actually grow in a different position all the way up that branch. In fact, if you trace them out, they're growing in a spiral pattern all the way up the branch and everything. It turns out that it'll actually spiral three complete times on this plant, three complete spirals around, and then eight leaves later, that pattern will be the same as it began. It will repeat itself throughout the plant. This is called the phylotaxis, 3/8. Now, do you notice both of those numbers? What are they? They're Fibonacci numbers. And actually, when they study plants come up with the phylotaxis of that plant, the arrangement of the leaves, they actually describe it as a fraction, where the top number, for example, the bass, elmwood, and a lot of the bulb plants has a phylotaxis of 1/2, where that top number is how many times those leaves will actually go around that stem before it repeats the pattern, and the bottom number is how many leaves it takes to repeat the pattern. So that top 1/2, the leaves will actually go one complete spiral, and two leaves later, that pattern will be replaced, or repeated, I mean. Hazel beech has a phylotaxis 1/2, apricot, cherry, willow, oak, rose, and a lot of them here have a 2/5. Again, two complete spirals around, and five leaves later, the pattern will repeat itself. So these are the phylotaxis of the plants that they've actually discovered out there. 1/2, 1/3, 2/5, 3/8, 5/13, 8/21, and 13/34. Now, before we go on, do you notice, first of all, what every one of those numbers are? They are Fibonacci numbers. Now, again, with the sticky side of your brain, take a snapshot of these and try to remember for at least a few seconds. All right? Now, the evolutionary world, they say, well, all this happened, this phylotaxis, it happened by somehow in the DNA of plants. The DNA got altered and changed in it, something like that. So that's why we see this pattern in the plants. I've actually read a lot on the evolutionary side on this, and I just say, huh? To tell you the truth, I can't make any sense of what they're saying. It makes no sense at all. It doesn't fit any logic out there, right? But this is a living thing. The problem is they cannot answer this. Not only do we see it in the living things, but we see it in our universe. For example, when we look out in our solar system, we see this number pattern showing up again. On the planets that are out there, when they look at their rotation, how long it takes them to actually make a rotation, they call a day. And when they compare the day of that planet to the planet next to them, their days, they come up with a ratio. Now, this is Pluto out here. They're still arguing that Pluto. It's not a consensus, by the way. I thought they'd made up their mind that Pluto was no longer a planet, but not all astronomers actually believe that. So there's still an argument, but that's poor old Pluto they're fighting over here. This is Mercury down here. This is us with our moon. But here's what they ended up with when they come up with these ratios. The ratio of Neptune's days with Uranus is 1 over 2. Uranus and Saturn, 1 over 3. Saturn and Jupiter, 2 over 5. Jupiter and asteroids. Asteroids actually are in an orbit out there. They can actually map and everything. 3 over 8. Mars, 5 over 13. Do you recognize these numbers right in here? These are the same ones we saw in the living phylotaxis of the plants. Now, if you have a real sticky memory, you say, oh, I see something wrong up there. And what is it? It's the Earth. The Earth on the phylotaxis of the planet is 8 over 13. On the plants, it was 8 over 21. So there's a deviation here. But why a deviation? Well, many of us scientists today believe it's because God thinks the Earth is very, very important. You know, a lot of secular astronomers are actually coming to that conclusion. There's a study out there called the anthropic principle. They've realized there's at least 30 different parameters out there that show the Earth is in a perfect position. It has perfect ingredients, more or less, for life. It looks, they're starting to say, it doesn't look like it all happened by chance and accident. It kind of looks a little bit like design. For example, we know today, or they teach us the anthropic principle, in our orbit out there, if we were only 1 degree closer to the sun, we would actually fry. 1 degree out close to the sun, we would fry. We would burn up. Only 1 degree out of that orbit, we'd actually freeze to death. So it's a very, very close tolerance that we have to actually stay in there. It looks like we're in the perfect orbit. You look at things like the moon. The moon, we know, is moving away from us very, very gradually, very slowly. But you all know what the moon actually produces up on the Earth, right? Our tides. It actually, by the gravitational pull, that's what makes our tides. And our tides are very important, by the way. It keeps our waters from stagnating. It keeps them moving all the time. Even on a nice little lake out there, you've got the water moving from the tidal pull and everything. And actually, because of the opposite and I forget the principle, but anyway, you're going to have two tides on every beach every day at a different time. Now, if the tides were much bigger, if the moon was much closer than it is today, the tides would be so huge that in a very short period of time, the continental landmass would have been wiped out by the water rushing up on the shores and everything. If it was much farther away, we wouldn't have enough tidal action. The seas would become stagnant, and we would die shortly after that. Why? Because all the life in the sea would die. Now, you say, that's all right, I don't like fish. Susan doesn't like fish. She told me that today, right? But I have to ask you, Susan, you like to breathe, though, right? Yeah. Do you know 75 to 80% of the oxygen we're breathing right now, where it's coming from? It's coming from the marine plants, not the land plants. Most of it is actually coming from the ocean. 70% of the Earth is covered by water. So it's marine plants that are producing most of the oxygen, taking most of the CO2 out of the air and producing our oxygen. So it's kind of important to keep our seas alive. Right? Other than the fish. I like fish, so I kind of want to keep the oceans around. But anyway, there's other things like gravity. Gravity seems to be just about right. You know, if gravity was much stronger than it is today, you would look very much different sitting in the chair right there. We'd be all squashed out. It'd be almost impossible to get out of that chair. If it was much less, you'd spring up out of the chair and you hit the ceiling. There'd be dimples all over the ceiling when people are getting excited for the Lord, jumping up in the air and choom. All right. And so even gravity is right. When we look at the oxygen and the other, the oxygen content, everything seems to be at just a nice level out there that we need for life. 30 different parameters. And you can read this on, there's quite a bit of stuff online about the anthropic principle. But they've determined that it's a lot more important that they believed in the past. And actually, God has always thought the earth was very important. It actually starts the very first revelation. In the beginning, God created what? The heavens and the earth. The earth has always been important to God. He starts with telling us about the earth, doesn't he? Right? And why did God make the earth? Well, the Bible tells us he made it for his own glory, but he also made it that it might be inhabited. Inhabited by who? By us, his most special creation, and all that other creation of him. So it's very, very important to God. Many of us believe that God, just by slightly changing that number, showed that he has set this earth aside. We are very unique looking at the other planets out there. He has set us aside. But yet, he still stays in his same building pattern right in there. We look at things like flowers. Now, if you guys get a chance to visit with Marilyn much, she will share with you that I am not a very romantic person. My wife has not got a whole lot of flowers for me over the since we've been married. By the way, next week we'll have been married 44 years. I think it's Thursday. I gotta look that up. I gotta try to remember. The reason I have to do this, we were only married. We'd been married just a couple of weeks, and I forgot my wife's birthday. And I have a hard time with dates, things like that, so I need to really remember. And if somebody will, after this is over, tell me where there's a nice flower shop. I don't want to pay too much money, you know what I mean? But I want some nice flowers for my wife. Anyway, I'm not the real romantic person I should be. I have to share a story with you. My wife was sick and in the hospital. I went out hunting, and I got lost. I didn't get back to see her that night. So the next day is they say roses will, for men, give your wife a rose, it'll cheer them up. Well, we were living in a mountain town, didn't have roses, but they had this beautiful flower. It had a really nice green stem, nice green leaves, and a beautiful purple bloom on it. I gave it to my wife, and she threw it back at me. It was made out of plastic. She just didn't. That thing is probably still just as colorful as it was from the beginning. It's some landfill over near Kremlin, Colorado. But anyway, I digress. Let me get back to this, okay? Flowers. When you look at flowers, most of the flowers, now there are a few exceptions, but when you look at the flowers, it's amazing to me that the majority of flowers actually have petals that are Fibonacci numbers. We have petals with one out there called the calla. So one, we have quite a few of them in two, then the number starts increasing. You get them with three. Now the lily up there, you say it's got six, but actually this lily here, only the blue is actually the petals. These are called, I'm not a biologist, I always say this wrong, a sepal or something like that. That's pretty close. But anyway, they're not leaves, or they're not petals. And then the next one you see a lot of is this one here. In fact, there you'll find more flowers and weeds, by the way, with five petals on the flower than any other flower out there. Don't take my word for it. Start counting yourself. My wife, if you have a flower garden, she will not let me walk through your flower garden without my hands tied behind my back, because I do count. And I have counted a lot of flowers, and that number five comes up more than any other number out there. Now, by the way, we also have flowers that have four petals, six petals, and 10 petals, which are not Fibonacci. But generally, not always, but generally those are, on the four, you'll have two going one direction and two going the other way. So you have a double twos is what you have. On the sixes, you'll have three going one way and three twisted the other way. Same way on the ones with 10, go five way and then five another. So you still have the Fibonacci numbers. They're just kind of stacked on each other. Now, there are exceptions to the rule. There's some other ones out there. There's another sequence called Lucas sequence, and if you want to learn about it, it's in my book. That's a cheap way to get you to buy a book, but anyway. No, that book is just for your information, guys. It doesn't make us any money, really. We try to keep it as cheap as possible just for information. Then we go up to 8 petals and 13 petals, 21 petals, 34 petals. My computer can't keep up. 55 petals and 89 petals. Now, this one is interesting to me. You see the one down at the bottom? And I'm not even going to try to attempt to say that. If you guys can say it for me. But anyway. Now, I looked at this as closely as I could, and what I could count of every one of these, there's actually 89 petals. But you don't count the split on the end. That is one complete petal, but it just split out on the end. There's 89 of these separate ones, but you notice how they split out on the end? Into that number five. That number five comes up again and again and again. Now, what they've done also, now mathematicians, they found out there's a sequence that also shows up within the Fibonacci numbers, ratios. When you divide one Fibonacci number into the one after it, you come up with a ratio. For example, 2 into 3, you get 1.5 or 1.5. But what happens very, very quickly from 34 and 55 on to infinity, that number very quickly locks into one single number. And that number is 1.618. Right in here, 34 into 55 is 1.617. 6, round the 7 up to 8, 1.618. 55 into 89 is 1.618. 89 into 144 is 1.6179. Round the 7 up to 8, 1.618. 1.618, 1.618 to infinity and beyond. That number locks in and it never changes. Now, way out on the end, you get little changes, but those first four and five numbers actually right in there stay real constant to infinity and beyond. By the way, that the other one I threw at you, Lucas sequence, does the same thing. It'll actually also lock onto that 1.68. It's just amazing number comes up. Now, They actually knew about this ratio 1.618 a long time before they knew about the Fibonacci's and the relationship, the ratios they could actually get out of Fibonacci numbers. The ancients, in fact, were using this number long before Fibonacci numbers were discovered. And they had names for it. In fact, they've had lots of names for it over the years. They called it the golden mean, the golden number, or the golden ratio. You'll hear mostly called the golden ratio in literature out there. But Leonardo, the artist, Da Vinci, he actually came up with the divine proportion because he believed it had to have come from God. And if you look at it in his work, this guy was brilliant. I mean, he was not just an artist. This guy was an engineer plus, wasn't he? All right. So he saw that a lot of divinity in this. He saw that it had to have been done by design. So they've known about it a long time. To try to explain that, what it is, we're going to get a stick, any length, it doesn't matter how long, any length, we're going to call that 1. Now, 0.618, that's what just came up in the green, that's just a little less than 2/3. Now, if you take the 0.618 and scooch it on to the end, what you get is a total length of 1.618. 1.618 longer than that unit 1 right in here. So the rest of the pictures, every time you see the green, you'll understand that that is 1.618 times longer than the yellow you'll see in the picture, another yellow line in there. The ancients have been using it for a long time. For example, the Greeks, when they built the Parthenon, things like that, they actually built the Parthenon. You can see the overall shape. A lot of the roof is gone, but you take where the roof used to be, it's actually a rectangle. It turns out this is a golden rectangle, where it is 1.618 times as wide as it is tall. They did that in their, a lot of building structures. They also did it in a lot of their artwork, their pottery, things like that. For example, the pottery is here. If you look at the overall outside dimensions, you can trace a rectangle around it, where the rectangle is 1.618 times as high as it is wide. You see the golden ratio within their artwork and within their buildings. And you go, you say, well, why did they do that? Well, you can actually go back to literature and find out. At that time, they were very much into studying nature and the beauty of nature. And they believed, as they were observing things out there, whenever they saw something that was very appealing to them, that looked just pleasing to the eye, that they actually considered beautiful, they noticed that somehow the golden ratio was incorporated in it. So they decided, well, we want to mimic, we want to mock the beauty of nature, so we will put that into our own work. So they were essentially copying nature, bringing in that 1.618, because that's how they saw beauty, and they wanted to make their things beautiful also. Right? A lot of artists have actually used it over the years. Leonardo da Vinci, for example, one of his very famous paintings, The Last Supper. Now, he did something here. Most artists, in fact, if you go to art school, they'll teach you, you never do anything like this. You never take the center, the focus, and put it right in the center. In fact, you put it in thirds, actually 0.618 or 1, usually a third to a two-thirds, someplace in there. Take it off-center to draw your eye to it. But he did it a little different here. He brought the main focus to Christ. And the way he did it was using the golden ratio. You notice this is the table at the Last Supper. You look at the pedestal that's holding up. They measured that. That's the unit 1. And then you look at these wings here. They're 1.618 times longer than the center part right in here. You have that pleasing to the eye, the golden ratio. The whole building, throughout the building, you see the golden ratio on his layout through the building. But the main focus is this window right here behind Christ. That is actually a golden rectangle. What it does is it just draws your eye right into the main focus. And the main focus of this picture was, in fact, Jesus Christ. So just using the golden ratio. In fact, today, they actually have the Photoshop and CorelDRAW. They actually have programs you can buy. Artists can buy these, and you can actually lay out your picture, and just by putting it into this program, it will actually lay out your picture for you and put it in right proportion using the golden ratio. And we're going to learn a little bit later, the golden spiral, using it within it too. So there's art programs out there that are using that today. Even in music. Now, I'm not a musician. I heard you guys singing this morning. It was so beautiful. I had to leave because if I sing, all you hear is a joyful noise. That's all you hear. But I have read that they have actually written that Mozart, Beethoven, and Bach, that they actually wrote some of the beautiful classical compositions and everything, where the first movement was 1.618 times as long as the second movement. Somehow, even without counting the notes and everything, overall we find that very pleasing even to our ear. Could it be, now this is a rhetorical question for me, but I'm challenging you, could it be that the golden ratio is one of the blueprints that God used at creation? I believe it is. And the reason I believe that is because we see it in our body a lot. And in fact, I'd like to demonstrate that. Jerry, I know you're way in the back though. Could you trot up here for me? You did such a good job of introducing me, I'm going to pick on you. Usually I pick on the pastor, but Pastor David is, they probably haven't made it to Wichita Falls yet. They're going to try to make it to Wichita Falls tonight. I'm going to get on the other side of you. I have here a little prototype. Actually, a man in Colorado Springs developed this. This is called a golden meter. What it is, it's a little ruler that articulates. Articulate is just a fancy word for bends in the middle. That's all that really means, okay? Now, there's a button right here. From this button down to this bottom arrow, no matter how you move it, that will always be that unit one we talked about. And no matter where you move it, from here will be one, and from the button up to here will always be, no matter how you move it, will always be 1.618 times longer than this bottom unit one right in here. So we're going to check you out to see if you're in God's... I'm going to try to clean this up. I wish I had some antibacterial stuff or something with all the gunk going around. I don't want to get you sick, brother. But you look right here. I'm going to hold it out. I'm not going to actually touch you with it. I don't want to give you my brotherly love here. Okay? So you notice I put the button on his nose and the arrow is right at his chin. Do you notice where that top arrow is? Right at the top of his head. Brother, you're in God's wonderful design. All right. Actually, I've been fairly, I don't want to say lucky, but blessed. All the pastors, I've never found one that didn't measure up yet, and that's always good. Right. I would hate to have one come and doesn't measure up. They might kick him out of the church. I don't know. But anyway, but what we actually find, on the average, right, from our nose to the top of our head, is 1.618 times longer than from our nose to our chin. Now, if you go home tonight after you're going to learn some more of this stuff and take out your tape measure, start measuring, and you don't fall into these categories that you don't measure up, don't panic, because none of us are perfect. I believe the only perfect humans was actually Adam and Eve. But once they sinned, all right, death came in the world, but mutations, mistakes come up on top of that, and there was no perfection. And mutations build up over time. So you won't find any perfection in us today. Maybe some of us are close, all right, but you won't actually find it. The wonderful thing, that God really doesn't care what you look like on the outside. He's looking at your inside, at your heart, isn't he, all right? But we find it. On the average, we find it even within our body in many, many places. Now, the book has a lot more than what I'm going to show you, but I'm going to just share a few. On the average, your elbow, from your elbow to your wrist, right in here, is 1.618 times as long from your wrist to that longest middle finger right in there. On the average. When you look at your hand, those bones from the first knuckle to the second knuckle, that bone right in there, on the average you'll find it is 1.618 times as long as the one that follows that. We find this again and again and again throughout our body. They'll get sociologists and things like that, psychologists, they'll get large groups together, and they kind of study this phenomena and how we perceive beauty, and they'll have a tables laid out with all kinds of pictures of all kinds of facial type of people. And they'll have the people go through and just pick one or two or three of what they believe is beautiful. And then once they're all done, it's amazing, most of the time the people will pick the same type of people, especially the ladies. And they'll say, well, they're very beautiful to us. They say, why are they beautiful? Well, we don't know, but she just looks very beautiful to us. Well, when you actually measure the ladies that they pick most of the time, it turns out that they have that golden ratio throughout their face. This lady here, her mouth is 1.618 times as wide as her nostrils right in there. Here's another lady who's very beautiful. Her eyes have the spacing of 1.618 times wider than her mouth. It's what we call the golden ratio. We see it throughout our body like this, and that seems to be how we see beauty. And by the way, plastic surgeons have really caught on to this. Most of the ones that make the big bucks today that are famous, especially in Hollywood, they use this principle all the time. If you go in there to get pertified or an accident or something, right, they will actually, the first thing they'll do, they'll just get out their tape measure, start measuring you, and then they'll fix what you want fixed according to the golden ratio, because there's enough of it in our body that we can actually know what one should be if it goes along this ratio. Dentists also use it today. There's actually a dentist, he's teaching this in the American Dental Society now. He has actually patented something very much like these, but they're a lot smaller. They're actually made out of stainless surgical steel that they also can measure that golden ratio by direct measurement. And what he does, he has actually noticed that throughout our mouth, our teeth, different teeth and everything, we have that golden ratio within our mouth. So just by measuring one tooth, he can know how far to push one out or pull it in to give us that beautiful smile that they like to charge. They charge my daughters quite a bit. Actually, they charge me a lot to make my daughters. They do have beautiful smiles today, though. Right? My parents didn't have the money to do that, so I've got what I got. Anyway, so that's being used today, even today. Even in our DNA. DNA is the basic building block. This is who tells us who we are. It has all the information that makes us unique, each and every one of us unique in that. But in our DNA, by the way, we've never actually physically seen DNA. Recently they took, I think, somebody told me, 7 strands and finally got a photograph. But we studied it from chemistry and all that, but we've never physically seen it. But we know pretty much what it looks like. We know it's in a spiral type of shape, but they've actually determined in the spirals, in the one complete turn, and they're very, very tiny, we can't even see it, but these small measurements is actually 21 angstroms wide and 34 angstroms long in one full turn of a spiral. Now, do you recognize those two numbers right in there? What are they? Fibonacci numbers. So even within the DNA, our DNA that tells us who we are, we see this pattern. Right? So I believe it's very important out there. Now, this was something I read about and was kind of surprised. Well, not real surprised, but you see, this is in two dimensions. Really, that's the only way. We're getting that 3D technology now. And so maybe 2 years from now I can show you this in 3D, but I can't do it right now. And you'll all look funny with those glasses anyway. But anyway, when we're looking at DNA pictures, we're looking at two dimensions. But what it looks like with the spirals, it looks like rectangles with the corners linked together, doesn't it? I read about this, so I tried it. So I took several different pictures of DNA that had been drawn out there and drew the rectangle right in there from the corner to corner and then measured it. And every time, every one of these drawings, it always had a rectangle 1.618 times as long as it is wide. So even in their DNA, we see the golden ratio within the DNA. And even in other shapes out there, for example, the pentagram. Now, the pentagram really gets a bad rap today. The occult, the Satanists, they use it, flip it upside down. They use it to call upon evil. But I believe the original pentagram came from God. And the reason I say that is because of the mathematics behind it. If you take the pentagram, they connect all the corners with the lines in between. You get from point A to point B right in here, then from B, C. Divide BC into AB, and guess what you get? 1.618. Pentagrams are actually golden ratios, and it's amazing how many pentagrams we see occurring in nature with this golden ratio. The flowers, the 5 petals, again, this is only a short list of them, but there's just so many of them in the pentagram shape. You look at other things like apples. Cut an apple through the core and everything, and the seed pattern inside, and what do you find? You find a pentagram shape. Even bananas. Are bananas, the ones that are imported into the United States, are 3-sided? Or 5-sided. Now, both of those, by the way, are Fibonacci zippers, or I call them zippers to get a banana done. But anyway, the one with 5, if you go not where it's connected with the rest of them, but on its own end, the opposite end where it's connected up, you look at that, everything that holds the zippers together, and it's a pentagram. Now, sometimes it's kind of distorted, but the overall shape is still a pentagram shape. You go to the ocean, it's amazing how many pentagram shapes you will find, not only in the ocean, but on the beach. Starfish, for example, sand dollars. Every time we go to Texas, we have to hit Padre Beach down there just so we can collect sand dollars. It's just an amazing little thing there. Right? And these are only a few of the many you can actually find in nature. And then mathematicians and artists and draftsmen have done this. They will actually take a golden rectangle that is 1.618 times as wide as it is tall, and then they'll measure that unit 1, and then they'll make a square 1 by 1 by 1 by 1. And what is left over right in here is another golden rectangle. Then they'll measure that one over 1, and then again make another square based 1 by 1 by 1 by 1, and again we're left with another golden rectangle. They'll continue to do this, drawing these squares 1 by 1 by 1, until finally they can't get much smaller, and then they'll connect the opposite corners of these squares with an arc, and here's what you end up drawing by doing that. It's a spiral. But this is a very special spiral. This is a golden spiral. You see this arc right in here. This arc right in here is actually 1.618 times longer than the one right before it. This arc right in here is also 1.618 times longer than the one right before it. This is actually called a golden spiral. The amazing thing is, when you begin looking at nature, there's lots of spirals out there, and almost all of them are golden spirals. We find spirals after spirals. You go to the ocean, you find a nautilus, a coiled shellfish, we call it. It's a spiral, a golden spiral. Snail after snail after snail are golden spirals. Things like ram's horn. We actually have a few of these living in Colorado National Monument, where we live in Grand Junction. Ram's horn that curls around, it's a spiral. It's a golden spiral. Kudu horn is my favorite antelope down in Africa. You look at it, you look those twisting up there, you measure, it's a spiral, a golden spiral. Seahorse tails as they curl around is a spiral, a golden spiral. A chameleon tail as they curls it up is also a spiral, a golden spiral. You look at the fangs on a snake, rattlesnake, some of those viper, different type of vipers. That tooth right in there is not the full spiral, but it's the arc or curve of that spiral. If you continue down, it would actually continue into a spiral, arc or curve. Even cat's teeth, those two teeth right in here, on the average, most of the time, they're actually curved into an arc of a spiral, a golden spiral. Beaver's teeth are golden spirals. Elephant tusks are golden spirals. Mammoth tusks are golden spirals. Warthog tusks are golden spirals. Wild boar tusks are golden spirals. Bear claws are golden spirals. Cat's claws are golden spirals. Now, if we go with Susan, Pastor David and Susan, they have two cats. Now, one of these can't run up her leg, can it? The little girl. She's got her claws done. But Kevin, they've got this boy cat named Kevin. He's friendly. When we get home tonight, he might run right up our leg, just so happy to see us digging those claws in. Now, Susan, if you get home before us tonight, don't beat Kevin off your leg, all right? Look down and say, praise the Lord. Evidence of God just running right up my leg, all right? Paul tells us how many times in the Bible, be joyful in all things, I guess including that. But it is actually in the shape of a golden spiral right in here. The talons on a lot of the raptor-type birds are actually spirals, golden spirals. Many birds' beaks are spirals, golden spirals, curve around there. Some spider webs, I said some, because there are so many variations in the spider web, but some of them have golden spirals like this one right up in here. It's always amazed me. I've actually sat down several different times and taken the time to watch a spider do a web. And it's amazing to me because they'll make these main runners, first of all. They'll put these in place, and then they'll come, they'll make an attachment. And then they don't stop like an engineer, get out their slide rule, which dates me, or get out their calculator and figure out where they're going next. They just jump over, make an attachment, and then jump over again. But what's amazing to me, when you get all done, what do you see? Spirals, golden spirals throughout this whole web and everything. Even our umbilical cord, this is what attaches us to our mother while we're still in her womb. Now, you don't want one like this. This one's been over-twisted. This is a dangerous type to have. But when you look at a healthy one, it's a spiral, a golden spiral. Even on our ears, we have not a snail growing in the dirt in our ears or the wax in our ears. We actually have this thing called a cochlea. It kind of looks like a snail. It's part of our hearing system, but it's a spiral, a golden spiral. Now, evolution would argue again, well, again, that's because of the DNA. The slight tweaks in the DNA, that's how we get this stuff. That's in the living things, though. How can they explain in the non-living? Because we see it throughout nature. For example, hurricanes. Hurricanes are very, very destructive, or they can be, but when you look at them from outer space, they're also very beautiful, aren't they? Right? And they're spirals. They're golden spirals. You look at whirlpools in the oceans, they're actually a spiral, a golden spiral, depending on what side of the equator on which way they're spinning. Ocean waves, as they break over, and you know, even lakes, once the waves come splashing in, they're also breaking in a spiral, a golden spiral. Spiral galaxies are not just spiral galaxies. Guess what they are? Golden spiral galaxies. High tornadoes, even those that are massive across, that are miles wide sometimes because of all the debris, but you look at the internal core that's producing all the energy and everything, it's a spiral, a golden spiral. Flowers, for example, the sunflowers and some of the acids out there, you look at their seed head right in here, and do you see the spirals in it? In fact, in the sunflower, there are two separate directions of spirals in the sunflower head. You'll actually see from the center going out to the left, you'll see spirals. You also see going from the right, you see spirals going here. Both directions, they're always golden spirals. They've actually done a lot of study on this. They believe this is the best pattern you can actually have with these two different opposing spirals, where the seeds will be about the same size in the on the middle as they're going from the middle out as the ones on the outside. So essentially, the whole flower head will have the same size seed in here. But then you go beyond that. You can count and know that they're golden spirals, but then you count the number. That one we were looking at, if you count from the center out, going to the left, there are 34 spirals going to the left and 55 to the right. So not only are they golden spirals, what else are they? Fibonacci numbers. And we find this on all kinds of the acids in the sunflower. This pattern shows up again and again and again without variation. Now someday they might find one, but it'll be a mutation because this is how the normal ones are described. Pine cones are the same thing. There's a lot of pine cones around here. You have a lot of these pine cone bearing type of trees. Pine cones are interesting because if you look at them, they also have spirals going in two directions. This one here has 13 coming out to the left and 8 going to the right. Here's another one right in here. Now, it's hard to see them when you first look at it, but with the magic of Photoshop, you can take these lines right in here and take your time and darken them. They actually call these bracts. I don't know where they come up with that, but these little portions are called bracts. So darken up the bracts, and now you can see the spirals where you can actually count them a little easier. This one has 8 going to the left and 5 going to the right. And what we find on the flowers and on the pine cones, the Fibonacci numbers are always neighboring Fibonaccis. They don't skip a number. For example, it'll go from 5 to 8 or 8 to 13, but it'll never jump from 5 to 13. We'll never find anything. They're always neighboring in that, without exception. Right? Cauliflower. If you are real, real evangelical, and tomorrow you happen to be down at Albertsons or wherever you like to shop, go to the produce section. You can grab a hunk of cauliflower, come up to somebody, say, "Hey, behold my God. You want to see my God?" Now, with the New Age running around, a lot of them say, yeah, that's God. No, that's not what I'm saying. That is not God. But you want to see evidence of God? There's enough evidence in this cauliflower that only God could have done it because it is packed full of spirals, golden spirals, and it turns out, or Fibonacci numbers. There's a Romanesque. This is a type of broccoli that is grown in over in Europe and also in Oregon. This is actually what they call, these little bumps on here, I think they call them fractals, something like that. What they are, they're like little clones. They're like a mirror image of the overall plant. Now, I've never actually got a live one in my hand yet, one of these days. But by looking at this picture very, very carefully, I could count the spirals in it, going different directions. So you count the spirals or Fibonacci numbers, and as far as I could tell from each one of these fractals, each one of these little bumps, it was like a mirror image of the overall. So this plant here is packed full of not only golden spirals, but Fibonacci numbers. Pine cones, you can do the same thing. You want to witness a pine cone? It's full of spirals, and they're golden spirals and Fibonacci numbers. And then they have plants. You have a lot of them growing, I noticed, here in the valley. These things don't require as much water as many other ones. These are called succulents. The succulents kind of grow in a flatter shape here. Hit the wrong button here. If you notice right in here, this is the center. I put a red dot. That's actually where everything is growing out, the center stem. This is actually the last leaf to grow out, leaf one, and this was the one that grew out before that, and the number three. What they've actually determined by that they can actually take and draw from the center out to the adjoining leaves right in here through their tips, they can draw a line. And what they end up with is this here. And they can this measure an angle. It doesn't matter. I could have did one or two or two or three or one or three. I would have got this same angle right in here, which is 222 and a half degrees, time and time again. They actually call that the golden angle. I'll show you why in a minute. Throughout the whole plant, throughout the species, you find the same thing, that angle 222 and a half. They've actually determined that's one of the best angles they can actually have, where every one of these leaves gets the maximum amount of sunshine and nutrients so they don't block each other off. Why is it called the golden angle? If you take a full circle of 360 degrees, you plug in that 222 and a half degrees. That angle right in here, what is left over is 137 and a half degrees. You divide 137 and a half into 222 and a half, and guess what you get? Surprise, surprise, 1.68. Now, friends, I want to share with you, it's obvious to me, I hope it is to you too, that somebody made this world. that it did not just happen by chance and accident. There's too much design, too much detail throughout the whole universe, I think, to ever have happened by chance and by accident. It just can't be an accident. That's my viewpoint. I hope you share that with me, right? But I do understand something, especially when I look at Fibonacci numbers in the hand of God, that this creator that we have, this God, our God, He cares about the details. I mean, when I see these numbers showing up again and again and again, that shows me it's a detailed God. But God also tells us how much He likes the details by His Word. Psalms 147, verse 4, it says, He telleth, He counts, He knows the number of stars, and He calls them each by name. Now, to understand what an awesome, magnificent God we have, today astronomers are guessing that we probably have 125 billion galaxies in our universe. This is what the secular astronomers are teaching today. And they say each one of these galaxies have hundreds of millions of stars in each one. In fact, Carl Sagan, he's dead now, but he was a very avid astronomer and anti-Christian, right? He came up with this. He says, there's as many stars in the universe as the grains of all the sand on the beaches of the world. You know what? Carl Sagan plagiarized. You know what he plagiarized? He plagiarized the Bible, didn't he? All right? Now, actually, if you quote God's word, you're not plagiarizing. You're just sharing it. He was actually sharing what God had told us 3,000 years before Carl Sagan. By the way, Carl Sagan used to sit around smoking pot to get these ideas of his. All right? He did. That's trivia, but you come to Colorado now, we have recreational pot. Oh, anyway, I'm not going to go there. By the way, that was Front Range. That was not us West Slope people, all right? We still believe in God and everything else that goes with it. But anyway, 3,000 years before Carl Sagan, the astronomers come up with this. God told us in His Word, Jeremiah 33:22, as the host of heavens, we're talking about the stars, cannot be numbered, neither the sand of the sea measured. In other words, we can never know, right? There are so many of them, they're innumerable, we can never count them. We can spend a lifetime and never count all of them. But God knows. He knows each and every one of those stars by name. Also, I think we can know from God's Word that this is a God that cares about each and every one of us. It tells us in Luke 12, verse 7, but even the very hairs of your head are all numbered. Every day when I take my shower, I no longer look at the drain because I'm losing hair rapidly as I get older, and I see it going down the drain. It's kind of sad to me, so I don't watch it anymore, right? But you know, even at that time, I could ask God, and if he willed it, He could tell me right then how many hairs are on my head. He knows how many on my head, how many on yours. Some it's easier to count than others, isn't it, right? But He knows the hair, not just everybody in this room, but in the whole world. This is a God that takes enough time to know how many hairs are on your head. If He knows the number of hairs on your head, He knows the number of the stars, and He calls them each by name, do you think He knows who you are personally? He's taken that time, hasn't He? This is a God that cares. And this is a God that demonstrated how much He cared for us. He demonstrated it upon the cross. One of the things I found very interesting when I was looking in these Fibonacci numbers, they've done some studies, and when we draw a cross freehand, especially children, time and time again, just freehand, we just draw a cross, and time again, when you measure it, it'll be 1.618 times as tall as it is wide. That's how we naturally draw the cross, even as a child. And I've been really looking at a lot of kids' drawings of crosses, and I have seen this time and time again. They're so close to this. Even on the cross, there was a design, wasn't there? And what was that design all about? That design was all about you and me in our relationship with God. See, we have a problem because of sin. For all of us have sinned. The Bible's very clear about that. We all fall short of the glory of God. But we have such a holy, pure God, He cannot look upon sin. And Bible tells us that we can do all kinds of things out there, but it'll never take the sin out of our life, will it? Right? Ephesians, I really like to talk about Ephesians 2:8, because we work with a lot of people over in Grand Junction that says, well, if I'm good enough, I'll go to heaven. But is just being good, is that going to get you to heaven? No, I mean, you can do all kinds of things. You go to church every time the church door is open. You can give to the missionaries. You can be joyful. You could just be obey your parents all the time and all that. Right? Or you can do works. But will any of that take the sin out of your life? No, God is very clear. In fact, on the good works, He tells us in Ephesians, all right, it's not of works, lest any man shall boast. So how are we saved? Ephesians tells us that too. It's by God's grace and our faith. Our faith in what? our faith in Jesus Christ, our belief in Jesus Christ, that He died upon that cross for our sins that we can never pay for ourselves. John 3:16, for God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in Him. That's the key word right there. See, you can know Jesus in your head all you want. I know a lot of people that can tell me who Jesus is. They can give me a history of Jesus, but they still don't believe Him. They've never put their faith and trust in Jesus. The key is you need to believe. And if you believe, then the Bible tells us it is a gift of God. And if you accept that gift, what's the Bible tell us? You shall be saved. I don't know where y'all stand in here today in your salvation. I pray, first of all, if you've never come to know the Lord Jesus as your Lord and Savior, this might be the day of your salvation. But I know a lot of you already have already done that. You have put your faith and trust. So my next challenge to you is this. Use this verse right here when you're out in the world. Start talking to people. Start sharing your faith with people. There's so many people out there that have never actually heard about Jesus Christ. And it could be, you might be their only chance to ever hear it. Now, sometimes, as I shared, it's a little scary thing to do. But all you have to do is plant the seed. The Holy Spirit will do the rest. All God calls us as Christians, He's given us a purpose. He's given us a job. And that job is to what? To share Jesus Christ with the world. So my challenge to you is, if you do believe, start being more of a witness to the world. Right? Because there's a dying generation out there that needs to know the truth. I've been studying Revelation at our church right now and seeing what's going to happen in the end times. And you want to know the truth? For those people I know that are non-believers, I have to weep for them because I know what they're going to go through. Do you want any of that to happen to your friends? Your acquaintances? I don't. Sometimes we need to be bold and just step out. Sticks and stones might break our bones, guys, but those words are going to throw at us. You can shrug those off. Because all you did is what God called you to do is share the word, okay? Share the